Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning. And may it please the court, my name is Andrew Koenig for plaintiff appellant Yolanda Martinez. And I would ask for 2 minutes to be reserved for rebuttal. Your Honors, as is noted in the motion for judicial notice that was unopposed by opposing counsel, my client was found disabled in a subsequent decision by an ALJ dated September 11, 2019, finding her disabled as of December 14, 2017, which is basically exactly a week after we filed the federal court claim. I often advise clients to reapply as a backup plan, and her administrative counsel did the same, and she ultimately was found disabled back to December 14th of 2017. And what's significant in that is there was a single limitation, non-exertional limitation, the subsequent RFC finding of unable to do low stress work. That was the single limitation. The vocational expert said if that was the case, there would be no jobs that my client could perform. That was a Title 16 only case. And so she was only eligible for disability benefits based on her date of application. That finding of unable to do low stress work is consistently documented in the record that we have at issue here from her prior alleged onset date of January 1st of 13 through the date of that decision. This is the prior decision. It is significant that it is a combination Title II, Title 16 case, and there's a date last insured of September 30th of 2015 for Title II eligibility, which obviously is very, very important to my client to obtain. And in that entire period of 2013, her alleged onset date through the subsequent decision, which is now a final determination of the commissioner, her doctors document that she is unable to do even low-stress jobs. The ALJ in our case did find her capable of low-stress jobs, and that is contrary to the evidence. Her treating psychiatrist, Dr. Guzman, who treated her 17 times in a, you know, three-plus year period between April 14th and June 17th, just prior to the hearing, found her unable to perform any type of work due to stress, totally incapable of dealing with any type of job stress. Her treating
with respect to Dr. Guzman's testimony, the ALJ discounted it because it was inconsistent with her activities of daily living. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think it's twofold. Number one, that the activities of daily living are not preclusive of a disability finding. They were basic general activity levels, and I believe the Garrison case, Vertigan case, these issues have been routinely found to not be indicative of activities that preclude a finding that someone is disabled. And second, it is important to put these into context. She did say she was only able to do these on certain times, certain days when her symptoms were lessened. And in the Revels case that I cited, the court said a judge, ALJ, must take those that context into consideration, and it's not appropriate to reject credibility of either a doctor or a claimant's testimony based on daily activities when only able to do under certain circumstances or under certain limitations. Dr. Guzman finds no stress. Her treating therapist, MFT Sullivan, found her unable to do any work stress. And what's very, very significant is Dr. DiGiaro, the consultative exam, the most significant finding she gave in September of 2012 was that she was severely impaired in ability to handle work stress. And that was credited by the ALJ, but he translated that into capable of low stress work, which is not supported by any other treating or examining doctor. The only doctors that might support that are the non-examining physicians, which if they're contradicted and their opinions are unsupported by the remainder of the record, is not substantial evidence to support the RFC finding that this judge gave, that she's capable of low stress work.
May I clarify one other thing? There was no evidence of malingering in this record, correct?
No, the ALJ found did not find any evidence of malingering. Opposing counsel made a point to accuse her of exaggerating symptoms throughout the record, but that was trumped up. It is not something that the judge found or based any decisions on. And under the Stout and other cases I cited in my brief, the court is restricted to relying on the findings actually articulated by the ALJ, not speculation or post hoc rationalizations made by counsel in argument. So the record is rather consistent and linear with my client's mental conditions. This isn't something where she deteriorated in 2017. The records are consistent throughout. Multiple treating doctors have documented the severity of symptoms as far as she's basically housebound. She cannot deal with people, work stress. The record is replete with her cutting herself when under stress. And if she's placed in a workplace, that is the stress that would trigger those types of symptoms. The record is absolutely consistent that if she was placed in work stress situations, these types of symptoms would flare. One other point I think is significant is there was absolutely no physical RFC limitations, despite clear evidence of headaches that Dr. Fenzi, her treating doctor of 22 times, did say they were stress related or mentally related. And she even had to go to a neurologist who recommended Botox treatment to treat her chronic migraine headache. That there is a very, very low step through threshold for physical impairments. This judge found no physical impairments whatsoever, and then resulting no physical limitations at all with her headache. So it are very, very well documented throughout the record. And I understand, mental affects physical affects mental in a whole person. But to ignore the fact that her mental stress, et cetera, triggers debilitating headaches to where she needs Botox treatment to treat is clearly an oversight, not only a step two, but in finding no physical RFC limitations, Your Honor. And if I can, I'll reserve the remaining for rebuttal.
All right. Let's hear from Mr. Talbert.
Yes. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Daniel Talbert for the Commissioner of Social Security. The ALJ in this case considered various impairments from many different medical sources, as well as statements from the claimant and other individuals, and he evaluated them consistent with the regulations and this court's case law. He relied primarily on opinions from seven different medical sources to conclude that the claimant had significant impairments and limitations, but that she remained capable of performing a range of simple, routine, low-stress work. This highly restrictive residual functional capacity finding reasonably accommodated the claimant's symptoms and limitations. We submit that substantial evidence supports the ALJ's findings, and this court should affirm on that basis. The ALJ considered, in addition to the medical opinions that he relied upon, he considered, of course, the claimant's subjective symptom allegations, but he found them to be inconsistent with the record, and he relied on numerous factors from the regulations in this court's case law. He found various specific inconsistencies, including inconsistencies with examination findings and imaging. He found concerns with noncompliance with prescribed treatment, as well as sometimes apparent overuse or even potentially drug-seeking behavior, sort of suspicious reasons for seeking early refills of prescriptions. And then also some inconsistent presentations when the claimant alleged the need for significant intervention, inpatient treatment or hospitalizations, which she in fact didn't actually require and the treating providers said wasn't necessary based on normal examination findings. He found various other inconsistencies between her statements and the records, but the bottom line is that the ALJ made a number of specific findings. and evaluated the claimant's symptoms, evaluated them based on what the record showed, based on the factors he was required to consider. And although the claimant offers another plausible interpretation of the record, a different reading that the fact finder could have reached, the ALJ made reasonable and permissible findings and inferences on this record. For those reasons, we ask the court to affirm the ALJ's well-supported findings and decision. I'm happy to address any questions that the panel might have. I realize there's a number of different issues and points that are here. I think a lot of it is fairly well fleshed out in the briefing, so I'm prepared to submit on the briefing if the court doesn't have specific questions. Yes,
I have a question for you. My concern with the ALJ decision was primarily that it seemed to me that he had given precedence or priority to non-treating doctors' views over those of the treating doctor. I thought our law was pretty crystal clear that there's a significant burden for the LJ to bypass treating doctors' opinions in favor of opinions of an examining doctor, or even just a reviewing doctor. So how would you address that?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. So for cases like this one where the application was filed before March 2017, there is sort of that source hierarchy and kind of the treating source rule that establishes that ordinarily in many cases the ALJ is going to give deference to what treating sources said as opposed to non-treating sources. And for that reason, this court's case law and the commissioner's regulations say that if the ALJ doesn't give the greatest weight to the treating source opinions, he needs to give, in the commissioner's words, good reasons, in this court's words, specific and legitimate reasons, and they have to be supported by substantial evidence. Our position is that the ALJ met that burden and satisfied that requirement based on his findings, and these are on pages 30 and 31 of the supplemental excerpts of record when he's evaluating Dr. Fenzi's opinion and Dr. Guzman's letter. So essentially the ALJ rejects them. Starting with Dr. Fenzi, he rejects that opinion because it is inconsistent because it's inconsistent with the record, including the claimant's activities, including also the claimant's non-compliance with treatment, which is for both the seizure disorder that Dr. Fenzi opines about and the migraine headaches. And then also the ALJ finds it inconsistent with some of the claimant's just general conduct. The ALJ sort of worded this as quest for benefits, which is admittedly a somewhat unusual wording, but that gets back to his point about the claimant presenting as if she needed significant intervention, as if she needed hospitalization to be admitted to the emergency room, but that wasn't really necessary. So the ALJ is rejecting Dr. Fenzi's opinion because he's saying, well, these allegations of disabling symptoms are not consistent with her ability to engage in various activities. They're not consistent with the record, which shows that she's not actually taking the medications for these supposedly disabling symptoms on a consistent and as prescribed basis. And there's other reasons to question the extent of the limitations that she's alleging and reporting to the doctors. With respect to Dr. Guzman, the ALJ notes, first of all, that Dr. Guzman's letter doesn't really talk about specific limitations or abilities. It's focused more on saying, oh, she just can't do any work. But under the regulations, and indeed this court's case law, specifically McLeod versus Astru, a statement from a doctor that a claimant just can't work isn't really entitled to any special weight. So we would actually submit that for that letter, that treating source rule doesn't really even apply. I think the regulations are fairly clear on that as well. I think we cite them in our answering brief to address that point. But beyond that sort of initial point for Dr. Guzman, the ALJ rejects Dr. Guzman's opinion because he says it's, again, inconsistent with the claimant's level of activity. And I'll talk about that just a little bit. this isn't one of the cases. There's two different ways that an ALJ could consider activities of daily living to reject symptom testimony or maybe a doctor's opinion. And one is, as this court has noted, if those activities seem to translate to a sort of work setting. The other one is if they're inconsistent with the specific level of symptom or level of limitation reported. And this is the second category. This is a case where Dr. Guzman wrote in his letter the claimant was homebound, she couldn't take care of herself, she basically couldn't do any sort of activities. And the ALJ says, well, that's not consistent with the record, which shows that she's able to go out to shop, she can drive herself, she can be trusted to take care of her nephew, she's able to interact with her family, she plays with her nephew regularly, she's also able to live with family at times, and then at other times she could live on her own, which is inconsistent with the claim that she's basically dependent entirely on other people. So really it's a case where Dr. Guzman and the claimant herself in her own testimony has alleged very, very significant limitations and restrictions, but the ALJ is saying, well, based on this record, I don't find that supported and I don't find it consistent. So our position is that the ALJ made those requisite specific and legitimate reasons, or good reasons, as our regulations would put it, supported by substantial evidence, for why he disagreed with what the treating sources had to say and agreed instead with the seven different sources who were the various examining sources and the non-examining sources who reviewed the records.
Counsel, I have one question. I'm a little unclear about the impact of that second ALJ decision that granted disability. What's your view? Does it affect this appeal? And if so, in what way?
Yes, Judge Donato. Our position is that it does not affect this case. And the basic reason for that is that the subsequent decision considers a completely different period of time. It considers, as Mr. Koenig noted, the period from December 2017 through, I think it was September 2019, the date of the decision. The decision we have here is through July 2016. So it's that subsequent decision isn't looking at the claimant's status for another 15 months.
I'm sorry, I may have misunderstood. I thought the second decision declared her disabled as of December, 2017. Okay, all right. I misunderstood. All right.
Right. So they're different. They're different periods of time. Right. I would note that. I mean, not to bog this down or any other concerns or anything like that, but I mean, this court has considered in certain other cases that when there's an ALJ decision that says the claimant became disabled, you know, the day after the decision under review, that's kind of confusing, and there are times when you need to look to send the case back on that basis because it could be irreconcilable. But in a case like this where there's completely different periods of time, you know, more than a year has passed, there's plenty of reason to see on that record that there could be worsening of a condition, there's new evidence, there's new things considered. Our position is that subsequent decision doesn't affect this decision at all. It's just a different ALJ. It's a different time period. It's actually based on different law too, because in March 2017 the regulations changed considerably. So for all those various reasons, the subsequent decision is not really material evidence to this case and doesn't provide any basis to remand.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Koenig.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I'll try to get all these points. The first point is regarding the last. All due respect, but I think it's rather disingenuous to claim that the second application has nothing to do with it because it's 13 or 16 months later. You're precluded from reapplying while the case is still at the appeals council level. As soon as the appeals council denied, she was opened up to reapplying for SSI. The judges cannot go back prior to the date of application to adjudicate anything. So he found her disabled as of the first day he possibly could, and she was precluded from applying before that. So it's rather disingenuous to say it has nothing to do with the prior period. Second, the period all the way back to 2012, the mental evidence is clear that this is not something that she has deteriorated over time. It's been consistent. Third, my opposing counsel says seven doctors supported this, six are non-examining doctors, and to Judge Gould's point, the only one that was examining was Dr. DeJaro, the consultative examiner, and that actually supports the claim of disability. The problem is the judge credited Dr. DiGiaro and then improperly translated her opinions into the RFC finding. There's nothing to do with missing work or interruptions from psychologically based symptoms, both of which were moderate, and then obviously the severe stress limitation. None of that was accurately reflected in the RFC finding. So the only doctors that support the RFC finding are non-examining doctors. Their opinions are inconsistent with the remainder of the record. Finally, if you look at the inconsistencies, so to speak, of daily activities, she drove herself home from the emergency room. The judge said, you drove. She was looking for work on Craigslist. He said, you were looking for work. And she said, I know I was cruising Craigslist, but I couldn't do it. So those are not inconsistent statements. She took them out of context. And I would ask for a remand for payment on benefits, but if not, I would ask the, your honors to limit the scope of review to the period of January of 13 through December of 17. So she is not put in the untenable position on remand of having to risk a subsequent approval, because some judges hang that over people's heads and say, well, look, everything's back the table as far as review. So please limit review if it is a remand for further proceedings. But I would ask for remand of payment of benefits. This record is consistent all the way through the date of allegation of disability to now. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you very much, counsel. Martinez v. Saul is submitted, and this session of the court is adjourned for today.
Thank you.